Okay, this is October 3rd, 1971, interviewing Frank Kerr, en route to Charlottesville. First moving interview. So, would you like to start off with the early days post-war and how CSIRO got involved in radio astronomy?
Well, it's probably worth going further back still.
Okay.
Just to say that Australia started off early in what you call radio propagation work or radio physics generally. But there was a pretty strong school of ionospheric studies going, well, I guess, in the early, or fairly early 1930s even. And that grew up because of the importance of radio in a big country like Australia, especially a country in low latitudes where there's a lot of static and so on. So there was a great interest in studying propagation conditions inside the country and also the shortwave links to the other parts of the world. So that there was a big group that started off in ionosphere work, centered on Sydney University, and the first radar people really came out of that group.
Was this CSIRO even before the war?
No, it was an organization called the Radio Research Board, which is a funny sort of entity. It had representatives from the post office, the army, the navy, I guess CSIR as it was called then, and perhaps a couple of others. And it ran a couple of labs, one in Sydney and a smaller one in Melbourne. And some of the early people, such as, Piddington certainly in Sydney, and Martin, and Webster, and Pulley, and a few of the others, that came into radar in 1939 from that direction. And the Radio Research Board actually continued to exist, but it stayed in ionosphere work, and CSIR set up the Radio Physics Laboratory in 1939 under secret conditions to work on this great new thing that at that time was called RDF, Radio Direction Finding.
Was this in conjunction with the English, I assume?
Yes. The name radar came in somewhat later. It was the American name, of course, but it was adopted in the other countries only a few years later.
What did CSIR stand for?
That's a good question. CSIR is Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. It started about 1920 or so, and existed in that form until 1947 or 48, when the organization was changed and it became CSIRO, which was more definitely a government department or government agency, Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. It did the rather unusual thing when it was formed. The circular went round everywhere to give the official spelling, and the unusual thing was that the organization was spelt with a Z, whereas the common English spelling, of course, is with an S.
Right.
So radar started up in 1939, and a fairly large lab was set up at 20 or 30 scientific people, quite largely coming out of electrical engineering in Sydney or from physics in Melbourne, two principal sources. And I personally joined it in 1940 in August. At that time, it had about 8 or 10 people in it. I think it grew pretty rapidly after that. first chief was D.F. Martin, M-A-R-T-Y-N. Then, about 1941, Fred White became chief. About 1943 or so, Taffy Bowen joined the place, firstly as assistant chief, and then he became chief in 45.
Let me just ask now, this was before, when did Australia declare war? I mean, this was solely in support of the British effort in Europe?
Well, Australia declared war at the same time, essentially, as Britain did.
Oh, they did, okay.
But the entry of the Japanese was essentially regarded very much in Australia as a new war.
Yeah.
And as far as radar went, it changed the directions of the effort considerably because, especially around 43 or so, 43, 44, when the Allies started the island hopping, going northwards up the Pacific, as was Japan, the Australian radar effort specialised on easily transportable equipment.
I see.
The stuff which you could take in from a shipborne landing and set it up in an hour or so and have it working, whereas the British and American equipment usually took several days to get going on any new site. So that was a special direction of the Australian work, especially later on. Also, there was a lot of emphasis on what was called tropicalisation.
Yeah.
That is making condensers that wouldn't grow fungus on them and so on.
Right. I imagine it led to more miniaturization also,
yeah.
Obviously portability.
Yeah.
And was this of some help as far as putting radio receivers at foci?
I'm sure it was, because it meant the acquiring of a lot of skills and abilities and that sort of thing. Now, the first glimmerings of radio astronomy, FEC, all the time during the war, there was a quite extensive information network for all this classified and secret information exchanged between firstly Britain and Australia, and then the Americans came in and came in on this network, and so we received information from Britain and America about all the things that were happening in radar and associated subjects under this sort of classified system. And that's where the first news about radio astronomy came in, really. Of course, Jansky and Reber were sort of heard of before, but nobody took much notice of them.
Right. Are you talking about now about Hayes?
That was the first one, yes. The story came through about what were they called? A special sort of radar set, the G something. Ground something, a fairly long wave radar set that worked on 4 or 5 meters. One of the early ones extensively used is in England. The GL, I think it was, gun laying. And they reported that they were often shooting at things which didn't seem to exist. And the operational research people in England studied this and eventually showed that the common object they were shooting at, which didn't really exist, was the sun.
Right.
So, I guess Hay was involved in studying this. that was the first real report of something excitingly new, because obviously it was connected with the active sun, and that showed promise of being quite an interesting subject.
I wonder, was it narrow sunspot maximum? I never have looked that up.
As a matter of fact, the sort of bench point I've got is that 1944 was a sunspot minimum.
So it was near a minimum.
In fact, the comment has always been made that the Allied advance across the Pacific up to Japan was greatly assisted by having a sunspot minimum at that time, because it was all done in terms of shortwave communication at that time.
I see, yeah.
And there were no radio fade-outs or anything like that that could have upset communications. And so this study of Hayes was about 1942, so it was when the sun was fading down towards the minimum. It was still moderately active, I think.
Right. There were no other sources detected accidentally this way, like Jupiter.
No.
Well, obviously not Jupiter, because that was discovered later, but...
This work of Hayes and the discussion of it afterwards really threw light on the mysterious events that had been reported mainly by amateurs about 1935 and 37 or so. The amateur journals like Radio News and so on were always carrying odd reports of the strange noises being heard just before a sudden radio fade-out. Now, probably at that time was when the fade-outs were first recognized as being something significant. And there are quite a few reports of the very strong hissing noises occurring just about the time of the fade-out. They weren't understood at all at that time. But of course, the Hay investigation showed that those must have been solar noise also.
Right.
But that was the first time that was really understood. So that was that one. I guess a year or two afterwards, we heard about the work of Southworth at the Bell Labs. They're getting solar noise at a much shorter wavelength. I'm a little uncertain at the moment what the wavelength was, but maybe in about 10 centimeters. But I presume from the quiet sun, it was a fairly steady sort of level. And a report about that came through too, so it was clear that the sun had these two types of phenomenon, great activity at long wavelengths and something happening at shorter wavelengths.
Now, Southworth was during the war also?
Yes, but apparently not connected with the war, as far as I know. It was just sort of accidentally at that time. Well, I guess it was connected with the war in the sense that wartime radar work made it possible to build decent receivers at 10 centimeters.
Right.
And so it was an investigation, I suppose, that was sparked off by the war.
Was this published, the Southworth?
I believe it was published shortly after the war, 45 or 46 or something, and it might be in something like the Journal of the Franklin Institute. But it was published, yes.
What about Hay? Did he publish right after the war?
I don't think it was published in a proper scientific manner, but you could undoubtedly find articles or discussions of it in somewhere in Nature about the end of the war period.
Yeah.
probably at about the same time that they were writing up all the work on radar in a public style.
Yeah.
These were generally not scientific papers, but in the form of reviews, rather, of what had been going on.
In fact, the one I'm familiar with is the MIT radar series. They might have some mention of it in there.
It'll be certainly there. I was thinking more of the journals. You're going to undoubtedly find something in some journals as well. But I'm sure it would be in the Radiation Lab series, yes.
Well, now, there had to be someone. Was there someone that had been an amateur astronomer or something like this that just had an interest in astronomy, or was it... I mean, what was the... was it Bowen who directed
it? No, Pawsey was the man, Pawsey. The father of radio astronomy in Australia was certainly Joe Pawsey. And he was, I guess his title was assistant chief or deputy chief or something, in charge of research during the war. And he was the one who was most concerned with all the radar propagation studies, with antennas, with TR switches. Do you know the TR switches?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Transmit, receive, the switch, which is an essential part of a radar set. It usually involves a diode or something that blanks the receiver off at the time when you're transmitting a pulse.
I see.
And he was a wizard on antennas and the transmission lines, switchery and waveguides and all that. So he was the main person connected with the research end of the radar work. And he was really the one who first drew the conclusion from these two pieces of overseas intelligence that here was an interesting subject to start thinking about as a post-war thing to do. And there were two sort of part-time attempts to do something still during the war. He and Ruby Payne Scott had tried out something on the roof of the lab building. That, I think, used a very small dish, probably in the 10-centimeter region, just poking it at the sun to see what could be received. And they didn't spend long enough on it to get anything out of it. And as mentioned in that article of Pawsey's I gave you a copy of, I tried something too, actually in the backyard at home. That was with the Yagi antenna and the receiver from one of the radar sets.
This was to try to pick up the sun also?
Yes. And something like a few meters. But it too didn't get anywhere. But this was because we didn't, in each case, we didn't put enough effort into it to really keep at it. There wasn't time to do it. But still, the idea was there in the background of several people's minds, especially Pawsey's. And so, as soon as the end of the war could be seen to be coming, and he and others started thinking pretty actively about it, and this was thought of as a good thing, a good subject for the lab to get into, partly in order to keep the lab in being, because it was a collection of good people, well trained in the arts of radio, and especially at that time, there was a feeling that it had been of great national value to have had the lab, and so it was possible to sell the idea to the authorities that the group should be kept in existence as a national asset, so to speak. And so radio astronomy really started in that sense. I said it was something that the group could do, and it would be a good thing to support anyway.
So there's no one that was really had a large interest in astronomy per se, other than a natural curiosity.
Yeah. Just the curiosity. Several of us had various degrees of amateur interest in astronomy at one time or another. But none of us really knew anything about astronomy much.
Yeah.
And it was just an intriguing sort of thing to get into.
Right. Excuse me, can you put the interior light on it? Unfortunately, there's no indication except to look at this thing to see if it's come to the end.
Okay.
And it's still going, but let me check how much. Okay, thank you.
And the other great thing that, of course, helped a lot in that early time was that we had a lot of radar equipment about.
Right.
We had antennas and receivers, and pieces of waveguide, pieces of transmission line, and so on and so on. And in fact, the very first work, I think, was done on an Air Force early warning station at a place called Collaroy, C-O-L-L-A-R-O-Y, on the coast north of Sydney in the northern suburbs. That was a station that had been operating for several years as a radar warning station on 200 megacycles. And so the first thing they did was to start playing around with that. And the first radio astronomy work was actually being done while the Air Force still ran the place.
I see.
I can't exactly recall whether the war had actually ended or not, or was in its fading stages.
What were the advantages of this place?
Well, it was an existing setup, you see. It was a complete antenna plus receiver, and Pawsey and MacCready and Payne Scott were the ones who did the first work there. And they found a pen recorder somewhere and attached it to the receiver, and they were in business. And that's the place where the connection between solar noise and sunspots was first discovered, or first demonstrated.
Sunspot group, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And the principle of the C interferometer was first used in radio astronomy there.
As described in Pawsey and Bracewell.
Pretty much. Of course, the C interferometer had long been used in radar. And this, of course, was one of the great advantages of having this group skilled in radar coming onto radio astronomy. But we knew all about the propagation of radio waves in the space above the sea, and the interference pattern produced by the signals reflected from aircraft. They came in directly and by reflection from the sea.
Right.
And so the way that you worked out how high an aircraft was to see how quickly it went through the lobes of the interference pattern.
I see, you actually did use that.
Yeah.
No, that couldn't be used at too high an altitude, though, could it?
No, it's only for low flying or for long distance stuff. Quite high aircraft could be picked up that way at long distances.
Well, what's the typical altitude limit up for?
In those days, a fairly high-flying aircraft was about 20 or 25,000 feet anyway.
But in terms of angle on a typical ship, How low did it have to be in altitude?
The ship or an aircraft?
How low did the altitude of the aircraft have to be? The angle altitude, not the...
Yes. This kind of setup that we had worked with the broadside array, the dipoles. It would give, I think, just roughly a beam width of, say 10 degrees in azimuth and 10 or 15 degrees in elevation. So that you can still see an interference pattern up to 10 or 15 degrees. So it was very natural to apply the system to the sun and just watch the sun coming up through the lobes.
I see.
And the position of the lobes in the sky was perfectly well known from the radar work, including what happened with refraction and so on. So it was a straightforward business to demonstrate that the sources of activity on the sun were related to the visible sunspots.
And these lobes were, I guess, a few minutes apart in size?
Or perhaps bigger, perhaps even up to a quarter of a degree.
That's half the size of the sun. But you could still see it go across the sun, I guess.
Well, yes. Yes, you're right. They must have been there. At least you could direction find to them. Say 2 or 3 minutes of arc.
Yeah.
That's right. The lobes were probably, say, 15 or 20 minutes of arc, and you could DF to a few minutes of arc quite easily.
Excuse me, could you switch the light back on a second?
Okay,
we've got about 2 minutes left, right.
So the early work was essentially done on the sun. It wasn't until, or perhaps a few months or a year later, that anything was done on the Milky Way, except just in passing.
This solar work was published.
Yes, there are letters to Nature. All the early publications at that time were in Nature, really. That's where you can find all the early stuff from England or Australia.
I think these references are all in Pausian Bracewell, aren't they?
I should imagine so, yeah. And you can get the exact chronology there, so it's probably more interesting to try and think of gossip.
Right. Actually, I've never sat down and gone through that book, so I'm not familiar, but you say he does have the chronology of the history of what went on?
But I was thinking more you could get the exact chronology from these papers.
Oh, from the papers, yeah, that's true.
Because they give actual dates and so on, at which the particular stations were being used, what they were being used on, and so on. Because it started at Collaroy, and shortly afterwards, the station at Dover Heights was used for the same purpose. It was an army radar station, more interested in looking at ships. And it was also around 200 megacycles, but they probably had something at 10 centimeters as well there, I think. Now, some of the early work was done at 100 megahertz. I was trying to think, that must have come after the army left. Is that 2 minutes up?
No, I'm listening carefully now. I can hear a very slight click when it ends.
Okay. The Collaroy station didn't last very long after the end of the war. It was closed down when the Air Force moved out and didn't want it anymore. And the work then moved to Dover Heights. That's on the southern side of Sydney Harbour. And almost directly east of the radio physics lab at its site at Sydney University, where it was then. So it was an easy half-hour trip from the lab. And they started off also on solar work, but they got into galactic and extragalactic work, or the common word in Australia is cosmic, actually. That you talk of solar noise and cosmic noise. Cosmic,
right.
Cosmic referring to anything outside the solar system.
That's what Reber called his papers, cosmic noise.
That's still used in the radio physics lab as the organizational distinction between them.
Now, you didn't mention, I assume it must have happened, but that the group's switch over in emphasis to radio astronomy was approved by the authorities, or... Okay,
we shoot now?
Yeah, you were saying it was approved.
Stage one was probably an internal manner only, internal matter, just to get agreement from inside the lab to do a quick pilot study just to see see what could be seen on that particular radar and whether it was worth continuing with. And then the effort gradually grew, and step by step it was approved at higher and higher levels until certainly by the end of 45 and early 46 it was a quite well recognized and well approved activity of the lab, and I guess it was officially budgeted for and so on.
When did the radio physics division per se become established?
Well, it became established in 1939.
Oh, so it was called that even before.
So it was just a straight carry-on from that. The only difference, at the end of the war, the doors were opened and the public were allowed in, and it was no longer secret. And instead of radar, there was work done on radio astronomy and on civil aviation work, that is applying radar and so on to developing navigational aids for aircraft. And there was still some work being done on valves, vacuum tubes, for a while, but that closed down after a while. And then later on, the other big effort started up on the study of clouds and rain.
We just passed a memorable tasty freeze, just for the record.
Is that very memorable?
You don't know that tasty phrase.
Oh, that is your famous tasty phrase. Yeah. Oh, I know.
I thought you did.
I'll bow down before it whenever I see it again.
No, we don't even do that. We usually stop for an ice cream.
Yeah.
No. Interesting point comes to my mind is, when did the term radio astronomy start come into vogue? Can you remember that?
That's an interesting question. It must have been around for a long time, because I cannot recall any specific start to it. But I think it was in use pretty early after the war.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been used... I'm sure it was used to describe this work in the plans and programs of the lab quite early. I don't know when it developed in England, but it's an old phrase. Now, a couple of other comments on organization. You can see that the cloud and rain work at the radio physics lab also grew out of radar.
Right.
Because especially in working around 3 centimeters, people were very conscious of echoes, different rainstorms and so on. So that grew up quite naturally. The other thing I was going to say, I just briefly said that as the doors were opened up at the end of the war, it's worth just mentioning that the change from CSIR to CSIRO that occurred in 1947 was a result of what would be called in this country a McCarthyist sort of operation. That the CSIR became politically unpopular in some circles because it was supposedly defending some left-wing people inside its organization. And there was an argument as to whether or not the organization should be doing any secret work or not.
I see.
And the upshot of it was that the only division that was still doing secret work, that was one that connected with aircraft, it was taken out of the CSIRO and put somewhere else, and ever since then there's been nothing secret in CSIRO. But the organization was rather changed and became somewhat more civil service in style.
I see.
But the great name at that time, person who was head of CSIR and was forced to resign in the changeover, was a person called Rivett or Rivett, R-I-V-E-T-T, Sir David Rivett. And he's very important in any history of CSIR, having built it up from the early days, and essentially set the tone of it that's lasted right through.
Let me ask a general question while I think of it. Namely, are there any sort of archives of history of the Radio Physics Division in Sydney?
Yes. All the old files still exist, and there have been a couple of projects connected with writing a history of the division that I don't think ever led to anything being very final. There was one project, a person who was librarian during most of the war years, a person called Marjorie Barnard, was going to write a history of the lab in the late 40s, and she probably went quite a long way with it, but I don't think it was ever published. But she actually was a novelist. Or she and somebody else wrote together under.
I see. So there might be a manuscript of that anyway.
Yes, quite possibly. Also, Arthur Higgs was at one time interested in writing a history, but I don't know if he got anywhere.
And who was he?
He had the title of technical secretary for a long time. And he was a person who'd been in the ionosphere business, so he was a scientific type, but he was the chief's offsider for many years. Someone like Bill Howard at NRAO.
Right.
And he's only just recently retired, actually, so he was in it for a long, long time.
So it might be good to get in touch with him anyway to see.
Exactly. Yes, probably would.
Well, okay, back to early days. We have these two experiments at these stations. When was it that actually, or is the next step, I should say, a station built specifically for radio astronomy?
Well, that came some time later, really, and still at Dover Heights. It's worth talking about some of the things that happened there that I guess late 1946 or early 47, John Bolton joined the lab, and he began working at Dover, and he and Gordon Stanley got interested in the cosmic noise, and they produced a map of the galactic radiation, essentially, over the sky at 100 and something megahertz.
This is in Nature?
That was in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research, I think, the predecessor of the Australian Journal of Physics. And that was a sort of a 15 degree kind of resolution. It did show show peaks in the Cygnus and Carina directions, probably for the first time. They started talking about the local spiral arm running through the sun. And also, shortly after that, the first radio source started to come into consciousness. The first thing on that was a report by Hay. It was Hay who first recognized the existence of a discrete or a small diameter source, and he recognized it through seeing fluctuations. This is somewhere in Nature. This was what we now know as Cygnus A. And his first letter merely says that that they found fluctuations in the cosmic signal from the approximate direction of the constellation Cygnus, and the presence of fluctuations must mean a small diameter source.
Right.
It was not until some time afterwards that the source was located more exactly. The source that was actually located in position, or identified with anything, was the Crab Nebula. And shortly after Hay's the discovery of fluctuations and suggestion of a small diameter source, that the people at Dover Heights, presumably Bolton and Stanley, they recognized the existence of a source in Taurus, and they found its position from the sea interferometer method and identified it with the Crab Nebula.
I see.
That was the first location and position of a discrete source, and the first identification with anything.
This was published in Nature?
I guess so, yes. And then, in a year or so later, 48 or so, 49 maybe, by that time they had something like six or seven sources. The Centaurus A was the other one that they definitely discovered, being a southern one, and that list undoubtedly included Cygnus and Virgo, and not sure which else.
You mentioned this 100 megahertz map they did, that they talked about the local spiral arm and all that. It seems to me they must have been really brushing up on their astronomy to know about such things, right?
Yes, during those years we all gradually got interested in astronomy. In the solar period, especially, Pawsey and MacReady went down to Mount Stromlo to start interrogating the astronomers and find out something about astronomy.
Okay.
And the person that they got interested in astronomy was Clay Allen, a C.W. Allen. At least the person that they got interested in radio astronomy was C.W. Allen. And he was a solar specialist, So he was especially good at telling them all about the sun. And the whole background to the way in which the sun radiated as a source, and the role of the chromosphere and the corona and the different levels for different wavelengths and so on, that was developed through the cooperation between Pawsey and Allen and D.F. Martin, who by this time was also an astronomer. At that time, the director of the Stromlo was Woolley, and he, of course, was not interested in radio astronomy, quite the opposite. But Clay Allen was so interested that he started a program himself, and he and Colin Gumm set up the Yagi and a receiver at 150 megacycles at Stromlo.
I see.
That was all radar surplus equipment that Pawsey got for them, I'm sure. And that was, at least, no, sorry, this was 200 megacycles. This was 200. And that was one of the first really worthwhile surveys of a hemisphere of sky. And it lasted as a valuable survey for quite a long time. In fact, it plus the corresponding northern survey a few years later by Priester in Germany is widely published as one of the first complete surveys of the sky.
What sort of resolution did they have?
That was, say 15 degrees again.
And
so in modern terms, it's not much good, but in those days, it was almost alone.
What is the reference for that survey?
That also was published in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research.
By
Allen and Gumm.
But what about this other 100 megahertz survey you mentioned?
That was Bolton and Westphal.
Well, why was that? Why was the 200 one better?
Well, it had a bit more resolution than the 100 megacycle one, I guess, because of the higher frequency. That's probably the reason. I see. The choice of these frequencies was almost entirely a question of what receivers were available.
Right.
And it wasn't until a few years later that people started making receivers, especially for radio astronomy. In the early days, they just used existing ones, or else built improved bits for existing ones.
Right. Now, what about this German survey you mentioned? I've never heard of that.
That was by Priester about 1955.
Oh, that late.
It was later, but it was still, 53 maybe, but it was still true that at that time there was no overall survey of the whole sky, and putting those two together was a useful piece of work. At a frequency as high as that, anyway.
Now, and where is the Priester survey published?
I'm not quite sure, I'm afraid. I've mostly seen it in the form of the combined thing, Priester plus Allen and Gumm. It came out in a German publication, first of all, perhaps the German Zeitschrift. But it's been quoted in various places. Sorry, I can't help on that better from memory. Now, they're still following this particular thread through. I haven't yet said anything about what I've been doing, but what I was doing, but they're following this thread through. The Bolton and Westfold, um, They completed their survey about 1948 or so, or 49. And in 1950, they both went traveling. I think Westfold actually went to spend a year or two in England, but Bolton went just to establish contacts with the rest of the world on this interesting new subject. And in particular, he spent a while, or the two of them together spent a while at Leiden, and they spent a lot of time with Oort. And there's a paper in the BAN or somewhere by Oort and Westerhout at that time, which was interpreting the Bolton and Westfold survey in terms of the thermal or non-thermal sources.
What year is this?
That's about 1950. It's all wrong now in terms of their interpretation, but that was because the angular resolution has smeared everything out, so they were working in a hopeless cause, really. Those were the days when people were all optimistic about correcting for antenna broadening and so on, the beam smoothing effects, or beam smearing effects. And in Bolton and Westfold's paper, there's a complete story of how you can correct for beam smearing and get back all the information that you'd ever lost through using a 15 degree beam instead of an infinitely sharp one.
I see, yeah.
Then at that time people hadn't probably realized that you can't get the information back, or you're going to get some of it back. And it was a few years later when a theory of this gradually developed, led by Bracewell. So at that time, people were optimistically trying to restore all the information in the maps. Another funny story, or a funny story about that visit to Leiden, that these astronomical innocents, Bolton and Westfold, had come to the fountainhead of all wisdom in astronomy. And in the course of some of their work, some results have had to be corrected for precession from one year to another. And the great Oort carried out the correction, and it turned out later he made the correction in the wrong direction. This is the sort of way that people acquired astronomy. It started very much at first through getting into touch with knowledgeable people. That's Alan in Australia, and the people like Oort and so on overseas.
I guess maybe Greenstein in this country.
I don't think Greenstein was terribly much involved. He perhaps was to some extent. Oh, yes, he must have, because he was the one who eventually got Caltech interested in doing some work. But I think he perhaps had a bit of the attitude of once bitten, twice shy about it, and he didn't throw himself into it immediately.
Which bite are you referring to?
Well. Interpreting Jansky, that he was one of the few people who ever took Jansky seriously.
Right.
But probably because nothing came of it at that time and nobody else was interested, perhaps his interest dropped away too.
I see. But anyway, we digress.
I've forgotten who all the other people were who actually got involved. But the astronomers as such, on the whole, did not get very much interested in it until quite a lot later. For example, Bart Bock in the early 50s was one of the first people in this country to get interested in radio astronomy.
Right.
And there's still at that time, there was not much interest at all.
Well, what did Bolton learn from his around the world tour?
Well, I suppose he and also Pawsey did some touring at that time. They learned that there's something about what were the interesting problems in astronomy generally, and acquiring some of the attitude of astronomers towards astronomy instead of just the electrical engineers and physicists' attitude towards astronomy. So that this it really set them interested in the future possibilities of the whole subject. That it became clear that it was worthwhile trying to develop the quite high resolution systems and pushing the subject as far as it would go, because it was clear that there must be lots of interesting things, and there are undoubtedly many interesting studies in the radio physics files at that time that discuss the future possibilities of radio astronomy.
Yeah.
I've got copies of a few of those, but probably a lot of the old committee studies and so on have been thrown out, I regret to say, as far as I was concerned. But I did it partly because I knew a full set of all of that stuff was on file in the lab, that they've carefully kept they've kept records of everything, as far as I know.
We won't take your amateur historian nerd badge away then. Your responsibility.
Well, I've kept a lot of it, and there's a lot of stuff there.
Now, did they bring back ideas for new experiments to do, I imagine, also? I mean, I'm wondering, for instance, the 21-centimeter effort began around this time.
Yes, they heard about the 21-centimeter line at that time, and the interest in it. That's the time when Oort was very interested in it. They had started work on it in Holland. And however, nothing was specifically started in Australia after this news got back, after Bolton got back, and after Pawsey had heard of it too. This was because they were pressing forward with other things. And in fact, no work started on the 21-centimeter line until after Ewan and Purcell's discovery. And until the news got back, and they hurriedly whipped up a 21-centimeter line receiver in about 6 weeks, and confirmed the discovery. This was only possible, of course, because by that time there was quite a pool of equipment around and people who were pretty skilled at putting things together into a system.
Right. Was there any fundamental difficulty in doing this line receiver?
I guess it couldn't stop them from doing it, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it couldn't have been too difficult if they put it together in 6 weeks.
Oh, no, just that they were so busy with what they were doing that was just put on the shelf as something to do later.
I see. You mentioned that you haven't been talking about what you were doing. Was this in a different line, I guess, than this low-frequency continuum stuff?
I came into it a little bit later. I was in the closing stages of the war. I was involved in the studying the performance of radar equipment, in particular the connection with weather and the radio propagation factors and the propagation in the troposphere and so on. And we had a program set up for collecting performance data from all the Air Force radar stations all around Australia and New Guinea, and we did a quite large statistical study, and that was before the days of computers too. We had many girls instead of a computer.
Desk calculators.
Yes. And and that really kept on, or the study of that stuff kept on for about a year after the end of the war. And so I was involved in that until sometime in 1946, or perhaps early 46. And there's a publication on that in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research about what was called super refraction and the performance of radar stations in coastal environment. And so I got involved in the astronomy game a bit later, and did it in a slightly different way, through actually applying radar itself. This also was using wartime equipment, was still lying around. And to begin with, we were following up another of Hay's discoveries. Hay, of course, got involved in radar echoes from meteors,
right.
Meteor trails. So we set up a radar system at a fairly long wavelength, with something order of 10 meters, I think it was. We were looking at meteor trails, and the other things were getting so interesting.
Continuing with Frank Kerr on October 3rd, 1971, and we're talking about the first radar